I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in a few minutes today, we're going to have our irregular segment, No Question Too Stupid to Ask. Today, the topic is the Euro crisis. So send us your questions at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, here's another one. What happened to Facebook? Stocks remain lackluster today after closing 11% down yesterday from the social media giant's IPO sale price on Friday. And the blame game is on. Some say Mark Zuckerberg pushed to overprice the stock because he wanted the symbolism of having his company valued at over $100 billion. Others are blaming those NASDAQ glitches on Friday, but could it also be that Americans are just falling out of love with stocks, period? Bloomberg Businessweek writer Robin Farzad joins us from New York. Robin, how about another thought? Morgan Stanley and other banks who helped orchestrate the public offering on Friday are also taking some blame because they propped up the stock on Friday?
Oh, ye of little faith in Wall Street. I mean, come on. This speaks to an age-old problem on Wall Street. How do you prioritize one client's interest versus another? It's necessarily a Janus-faced dilemma, and you saw Goldman Sachs had to deal with this with respect to their handling of subprime securities during the crisis. In this case, you had one client of Morgan Stanley's, Facebook, saying we want to get as high a price as possible, and another client, the institutional clients, who are going to be the big recipients of this IPO, saying we expect you to give us more information at the outset. So then who's stuck holding the bag is the little guy, the retail investor, a.k.a. on Wall Street, dumb money.
Well, you know, we're hearing today about, you know, students who, you know, bought 50 shares at $38 a piece and are now selling them and taking this 11% loss. Tell us more about, you know, how stocks are gauged. Something called the price-to-earnings ratio divides a company's stock price by its annual earnings per share. All we need to know is that Facebook's ratio is awfully high. It's trading at 74 times its earnings. Apple's around 13. Google's around 18 times. And by the way, we're seeing investors seeming to flock to Apple this week, maybe away from Facebook. You know, what's your sense of that ratio?
Well, it's a time-tested kind of back-of-the-envelope formula, price to earnings. It's the simplest way to look at a stock. It's like, you know, you look at a student in terms of GPA. The problem with a hyper-growth company like Facebook or even Google in its infancy is you can't pay so much attention to that denominator, the earnings denominator, because if they're growing so rapidly, who cares if people expect them to earn a buck a share this year? It could end up being $3 or $4 a share. And it's the same thing with Apple. If you were to tell me what Apple's price-to-earnings multiple was in 2005 and 2006, it had no idea what the earnings potential of this company was when an iPad or an iPhone 4 would have come online. And similarly, I think the supporters of Facebook are saying that this is such a paradigm-shifting company that's going to own whole swaths of the internet and chunks of online advertising that it's kind of it's premature at this point to assign a PE multiple to.
Yeah, but meanwhile, you know, we're seeing advertisers move away. GM, for instance, saying we're just not, you know, it's got nice cred to be on Facebook's website, but nobody's clicking on. People aren't buying. Doesn't Facebook have to prove that it can do more with advertising?
It's proving quite a bit on desktop advertising. The difficulty, and this gets to kind of some of the Morgan Stanley controversy, is was there a tip of the hat during the IPO pricing process that Facebook is kind of saying that, look, the world is moving to mobile computing. More and more people are using their Facebook apps on their iPhones and on their iPads and whatnot. And we, frankly, don't have mobile advertising figured out. It's a whole different beast than the ads that pop up on the margins when you have a web browser open on your desktop or even laptop computer.
Yeah. So and Facebook has acknowledged that it wants to leverage mobile more than it has. But what about questions about Wall Street after Friday, those NASDAQ glitches? What are some of the thoughts there?
It's interesting because you have, you know, the old picture that you get of Wall Street and the New York Stock Exchange and these yelling floor traders and specialists, that's supposed to be an anachronism, that the human heartbeat, the sentient being, was overrated. You can ultimately match buyers and sellers the most efficiently with a computer, and that's what the NASDAQ does. It's essentially a big computer with a display in Times Square that matches buyers and sellers, and that system got really backed up, and you have critics saying that could really have benefited with the help of 5 or 6 people or maybe 20 people to traffic cop the buy and sell orders. And it was pretty embarrassing for the NASDAQ what happened.
Is that it? Really just a human thing? Just more people were needed?
It's difficult when you have someone that has to require an orderly market, when you have such a back order of buys, of people who have certain conditions of, I want to buy the stock if this happens, but only if this happens at the open. only a human could truly discern, could truly eyeball how to handle that at the last minute. That's the argument, of course. The NASDAQ would like to say that it was just a one-time thing and there was record demand and we had to equilibrate supply and demand, yada, yada, yada.
Well, Robin Farzad, one last thought. You're reminding us that many investors are saying, wait a minute, Facebook still has a lot to prove and wait it out. But what does its disappointing couple of days here mean for other technology companies that might be waiting in the wings to go public?
Well, ideally, if you're the other companies, you'd want there to be a frothathon. You want Facebook to do really well so you can kind of follow on its coattails and say, yeah, we're gonna do like they did and have a blockbuster IPO. Let's not forget that Facebook made a ton of money on this IPO. They sold at a very rich price and they banked money for their shareholders. And maybe if you interview Mark Zuckerberg or get a couple of beers into him, he'll say that I didn't want those first day pop people. I want people who would stick with me quarter to quarter, year through year, and let me prove myself as a public company. But this does not make life easier for any of the secondary or tertiary social media companies that have been waiting to go public.
All right, I'll put it on my to-do list. Get a couple of beers into Mark Zuckerberg.
I don't even know if he's old enough to drink.
That's right. Robin Farzad of Bloomberg Business Week, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, so everyone who fully understands every aspect of the European debt crisis, raise your hand. All right. Well, there's one being raised in the studio, and it's our guest, because with debates over austerity, growth, that new word Grexit, meaning the strong possibility that Greece might exit the eurozone, let's face it, some of us have never really understood the euro, which only formally replaced European currencies in 2002. And Greece is now talking about going back to the drachma. Can they do that? Would that be like Alabama deciding to trade in tobacco leaves or Texas going back to star money and redbacks? We have questions. We want to hear yours about the euro crisis. Send them to hereandnow.org. You can tweet to @hereandnow or go to facebook.com/hereandnowradio. Because today, our irregular segment, No Question, Too Stupid to Ask, our guest, economist Richard Parker, professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. He also served as advisor to the Greek government that preceded the one that was just in elections. We'll, you know, catch up on that as well. But Richard, how did we get to this? Because critics of Greece are saying, you know, they were spending like drunkards for decades before the government in 2009 that you worked with that tried to do some reform. And there was a regulating mechanism in the euro, the Eurostat, that yokes all these countries together. So shouldn't people have seen Greece's overspending?
So here's part of the problem, which is when narratives get lodged in the public mind and they're amplified by the media, they take on a life of their own. Let me just share a few facts with you. First of all, the OECD shows the share of GDP paid in taxes by all the member countries. Greece pays roughly a third of its GDP in taxes. That's more than Americans pay as a share of GDP in taxes in this country. We've heard for years about them not paying their taxes. That's not the story. The story is that there is heavy tax evasion on income tax, both at the personal and corporate level. But the Greeks collect an enormous amount of money relative to the size of their economy through value-added taxes, which are kind of like a sales tax, through excise taxes on gasoline and alcohol and cigarettes, and on Social Security taxes. And European Social Security taxes take closer to 15% to 20% of a paycheck rather than the 6% that we do here
in
the U.S.
But this is the, you know, the people, the taxes that people were spending. We hadn't even gotten to that yet. But the accusation is that the government was spending money, in fact, cooking its books.
Yeah. So, again, both of those need to be revisited. One way to revisit the recklessness of the Greek government is to look at the debt to GDP ratio. And what you see is that the debt to GDP ratio of Greece from the mid-1990s up to 2007 was flat. That is, the debt of the government was not growing faster than the economy was growing. And the Greek economy was the fastest growing in Europe.
So what happened?
Well, what happened was that Greece turned out to be roadkill as a consequence of the meltdown of American markets in 2007, 2008, and 2009, and the spread of that American disaster onto Europe. Because what happened was that old and easy ways to make money, like collateralized debt obligations, suddenly became an impossible source of future funds. And now you had to find new ways to make money. And one of them was the realization that Greece was a vulnerable economy because of its size compared to Germany. And it was only 2% of the European market. And so savvy hedge fund traders went after them.
Okay. But I still have to keep you on this one point.
Sure.
Didn't Greece cook the books? I mean, we're seeing that this Eurostat, which is charged with keeping an eye on the regulations. I mean, Europe had requirements. You had to have only a certain amount of debt. And Eurostat was charged with keeping track of these statistics. And they couldn't because we understand at one point Greece officials left off the military expenditures. Another time, billions in hospital debt.
I mean, we haven't got the time to go through this. I can go through every single one of these because I had to look at it in order to work on projections for the Greek economy. What was happening was, yes, there were defects in the ways that records were being kept. There was a big showdown in, I think, 2003, 2004, and Eurostat broadly came away satisfied after 2004 that things had been cleaned up. The military issue was, do you book the cost of a new weapon system at the time you place the order, or when you actually receive the components? In other words, it's a question of a cash flow versus a cumulative measure of the cost of the weapons.
Well, so you're saying that it was more of a
What I'm trying to say is that
bookkeeping.
Here's what I'm trying to say, which is, it's really easy to single out the Greeks and say they were like five standard deviations away from normal behavior, and they brought this all on themselves. That's a very convenient way of not acknowledging that we're all in this mess together, and that a great deal of the cause of the mess in Europe came from the deregulation of finance here in the United States over the last 30 years.
Well, and we know that Spain, Ireland, Portugal are also in trouble. But the point is that Greece is the one that was failing. Other European countries make a deal to save it, only if Greece has these incredible austerity cuts, raising retirement age, imposing sharp pay cuts on public sector workers. What's been the effect economically and politically?
Two things. One is that the economy has contracted faster than the IMF or the EU thought it would, and we can talk about why that happened. The second is that politically, as you can imagine, in an economy that has over 20% unemployment, there's an enormous amount of popular frustration. It's frustration with the Greek government, and it's frustration with the European bankers, the so-called troika of the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the European Community.
The economy in Greece has gotten worse.
It continues to get worse.
Economist Richard Parker of Harvard's Kennedy School. We were just talking about the austerity program undertaken by Greece under orders from other countries in Europe who were willing to help the country out and paying back its lenders, but only if Greece took real tough cuts in its paying to public workers, for instance. Some are saying that didn't work. And we're hearing now, Richard, about spending. In fact, today, a leading analyst group is warning that Europe risks falling into a severe recession. You know, its economy's going backwards if something isn't done to promote growth. Where does that money come from?
It comes from borrowing. This is the essence of what Keynesian economics created as a revolution in the 1930s. And in the last 30 years, with the rise of Reaganomics to the center of public discourse, we've forgotten these lessons. Paul Krugman has been very helpful in trying to hammer home the point that you reach in a depression where private investors are no longer willing to invest. The government has to step up, borrow money, and put people to work. That's the essence of Keynesianism, to restart the economy. What happened was that we've ignored those lessons because fundamentally conservative governments were in power in Berlin, conservative governments were in power in Paris and in London, and they did not like going down the Keynesian path. So they said, let's try austerity, and they couldn't show you where it had worked.
Well, yeah,
and so we got a natural experiment all over again that shows you that it doesn't work.
Well, you point to a time in history, 1937, you've been here before to talk about that, when it didn't work.
Yeah, no. I mean, the precedent is that Roosevelt was convinced by his Treasury Secretary after the 1936 elections to start cutting back the government deficit to return to the sound money ideas of the Republican Party then. And it pushed the country right back into a deep recession within the middle of the Depression.
Well, but you know the arguments against stimulus. I'll just tick through some. It can cause inflation. Governments can't wisely make economic choices. It's pork laden. And then, you know, the question that keeps coming, where does the money come from?
On the first, the idea that it would cause inflation, you'd have to show me evidence that there's any risk of inflation. We have record low interest rates, and the first rule that an economist tells you is that a sign of rising inflation fears is a rising interest rate. So no evidence whatsoever to support the inflation claim. The second is that government screws up about as often as corporations do, and if we think that the private financial sector is to be trusted, great. I'll vote against you, but you run for it.
Yeah.
I don't think the last 5 years have convinced the Americans that deregulating finance was such a smart idea.
But what about the people in Europe? We have here, well, we've seen the outrage on the streets of Greece, but we're also hearing, I mean, we have just anecdotally a colleague who has relatives in Belgium screaming, why should I bail out Greece? What about that notion? I mean, we're going to see the opposite protests on the streets of the countries that have to do the loaning.
Look, this is an issue of localism that the United States has faced before. And because it's more federalized than Europe, it resolves by doing this at the Washington level. If we were still under the Articles of Confederation and Rhode Island had to loan money to Virginia, you'd be hearing the same thing. These are the agonies of local people thinking from a local position, but not about the health of the whole. The virtue of the federal system of the United States is that it has this unified central mechanism for making those transfers that have allowed the country to grow much more evenly. That's what Europe is now moving toward, albeit in a raggedy way. But, you know, the whole process of European integration since the Second World War has been raggedy.
You know, it's funny. We heard some people saying this morning, just kind of as we were trying to think this out. Well, don't some states here in the United States subsidize other states that are poor?
Massachusetts subsidizes much of the South of the United States.
Okay, we'll hear from our friends in the South. But here are some questions, meanwhile, that we're getting from people on Facebook, for instance. Philip Acebo writes, we were planning on retiring in Spain in 2 years. Is that a good or bad idea?
It's a good idea, but I'd probably keep my Social Security checks coming in dollars and not immediately convert them into pesetas. We don't know how these currencies are going to settle out. I'm sorry, in euros.
Yeah, I was going to say.
No, sorry about that. That we don't know how these currencies are going to settle out over the next 2 years.
Well, but what happens if Greece does leave? I mean, because of all the exit clauses of the euro, they'd have to leave the European Union. Can they really function
There's no provision in the treaties that created the euro for anybody to leave, so they're going to have to wing it. If they intend to leave.
And can they be on the drachma and, you know, a traveler from the U.S. coming with euros going through Greece?
Well, if you're a vacationer from the United States and Greece goes to the drachma, it's going to be a lot cheaper to go vacation on Crete than it is to vacation in Mallorca. There's no question about it. But here's what the Greeks face. They import all of their petroleum. They import all of their vehicles. They import 30% of their food. And the drachma is going to crash by 50 to 75% immediately after they leave the euro, which means that if it crashes 50%, oil's going to be twice as expensive, cars are going to be twice as expensive, and the portion of food that they import is going to be twice as expensive. The cost, in terms of daily life and the immediate health of the economy, is really going to be savage. And the theory economists have is that you increase exports. Greece does not have that much that it can really ramp up to export that is going to close the gap very quickly.
Another question from our website. Quincy writes, I've heard the size of the entire Greek economy is roughly about that of New York City. How can this be that big a problem for Europe? Haven't we, you know, made rescues like this before? It just seems like
That's a terrific question. And again, it goes back to this federal situation in the United States versus the non-federal system of Europe. What you got was essentially in the reaction to Greece, the same reaction that the Ford administration had initially to New York City's bankruptcy in the 1970s, which was, as that headline said, drop dead New York City. Mm-hmm. But what happened was the federal government then did rally. And with Roatan and wise advice from New York bankers, you got New York City back and going again. What's happened is that because you've cobbled together coalitions of the more powerful countries, and they in turn have been worried not just about Greece but about their own banks, nobody has come forward with a clear, simple plan early on that would solve this problem, and that's what's needed.
Richard Parker of Harvard's Kennedy School. I want to get one last one in here from Kim Scott, again on our Facebook wall. We're planning to move to France in the next 6 months and buy a home. Can we expect the euro to dollar rate to drop any lower?
You can expect it to fluctuate. You should have bought the house in France in the Mitterrand years when the ratio was about 8-1.
Yeah, but...
Too late.
All right. Richard Parker of Harvard's Kennedy School. Hope we got some of your questions answered. Boy, it just flies. We will have to do this again.
More fun than the euro crisis.
Thanks so much, Richard.
Nice to be here.
Niagara Falls, the most powerful waterfall in North America, is in the news. A man's in stable condition after falling 180 feet over Horseshoe Falls. That's the tallest of the three falls that makes up Niagara. It was an apparent suicide attempt, and he becomes the only third person to survive that fall. Meanwhile, daredevil Nick Wallenda is preparing to be the first to walk a tightrope across the falls on June 15th. And he's now going to have to wear a harness when he does it, something ABC, which is broadcasting and co-sponsoring his walk, has just insisted on. Ed Dranch is a reporter for WIVB, the CBS affiliate in Buffalo. Ed, Nick Wallenda had to go through a lengthy process to even get permission to do this. You know, he's paid a lot out of his pocket, but you don't just walk across the falls.
It's true. This is a process that's spanned about a year. He had to change two different laws in two different countries, the United States and Canada. It took a while for him to actually get those laws passed. New York State jumped on board right away, legislation passed right away. But in Canada, he kind of faced a lot of adversity from the Niagara Parks Commission. At first, they had said, we don't want this happening. We have a history of honor here at Niagara Falls in Canada, and we don't allow stunting. They saw this as a stunt rather than an art and a performance. So a couple months ago, I believe it was February, that they actually decided to allow this to happen on June 15th. So it was about a year process, and it was an arduous task for Nick Wallenda to actually get this passed.
Well, and we understand part of the thinking up there in that beautiful corner of New York State up in the Buffalo area, which has seen some hard times, part of the thinking is that it would bring even more tourists than already come. It would be a financial boom. And I've seen pictures of people coming to watch him practice. People have been talking about it. Has it had the effect that legislators hoped for?
It's fascinating to watch him practice at the Seneca Niagara Casino in Niagara Falls. You know, it's estimated that this will have a $120 million impact on the Canadian side. Here in the United States, it's not quite as much.
Why so much more on the Canadian side?
It's because it's more of a tourist destination on the Canadian side. There's much more to do for people who are visiting from outside the area. Here in Buffalo, there's not a carnival atmosphere. It's a park. Quite honestly, Niagara Falls, New York, doesn't have as great of a view that Niagara Falls, Ontario has
Falls. Yeah, but it's gorgeous up there.
So. It is. No, it's absolutely gorgeous, no matter where you are.
Well, of course, Nick Wallenda, and most people know, just one of the many high wire descendants of Carl Wallenda, who died in 1978 when he fell. We know that Nick Wallenda had a scare a while back, just a few weeks ago. He was in Baltimore, and he had a little bit of a slip on a wire there. What is he saying about his feeling of pulling this off, especially now that ABC is requiring that he wear this harness, which we understand he's not happy about?
He's not too happy about it. You know, I have every confidence in him, though, after watching him, that he will pull this off without a problem. The City of Niagara Falls firefighters yesterday were spraying heavy mist on him, and they had airboats set up with those massive propellers blowing high winds at him so that he could feel what it would be like to walk over the Niagara Gorge. You know, he's not happy that he has to wear this safety tether because he's never practiced with one. To him, it's more of a hindrance than a help. And he almost believes in his family history enough to risk his life despite what happened to Carl Wallenda back in the 1970s.
Well, it's quite something. We know that his wife and young children have been with him there when he's practicing. He's practiced with his mother as well, do we understand?
His mother hasn't been at the practice sessions. He's practiced at his Sarasota, Florida home with his mother. His mom is part of his traveling troupe. We've seen her balance on a chair on a shoulder harness, which is almost like, you know, the famous Wallenda pyramid that Carl was a part of back in his heyday.
And how are people in the Buffalo area reacting, not to tourists, but the people who live there?
You know, it's kind of a mixed reception. People are so thrilled that this is going to be such a spotlight on the Niagara Falls region, and people are expecting some sort of a return from this. Others, on the other hand, say they don't want to see a man risk his life. They don't think it's good for the area. But the bottom line is it puts Niagara Falls in the spotlight, which is only a benefit for the region.
Well, we should say that ABC has said that when they air the walk over the falls in a three-hour special, they plan a 5 to 10 second delay, just in case. Ed Drance, news reporter for WIVB, the CBS affiliate there in Buffalo, New York. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Voters in Egypt head to the polls tomorrow to cast their ballots in the country's first real democratic presidential election. And according to our next guest, the results are completely up in the air. An Islamic candidate might win. After all, Islamic candidates dominated January's parliamentary elections. But a secular candidate might also come out on top. A candidate who represents the old regime of Hosni Mubarak also has a good chance, although there are no candidates representing the people in Tahrir Square who helped topple Mubarak. Journalist Thanasi Kambanis, just back from Cairo, joins us. We'll link you to his writing at hearnow.org. He's in the NPR studios in New York. So, Thanasi, completely unpredictable, you say, but 13 candidates on the ballot. How many in real contention?
Well, there's two have already dropped out and thrown their support to others, and there's really five who have a fighting chance. And I'd say it's kind of appropriate that we're talking about this right after talking about a high wire act over Niagara Falls, because frankly, the Egyptian election is like 5 or 10 politicians trying to get from one bank, which was Mubarak's Egypt, to something more democratic on the other side. And there's no clear sense that they can get across it without falling down.
Right. Let's go through the contenders. You write about Mohammed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. And we start there because the question many in the West have is, how Islamist are the Islamic candidates? Are they, you know, for strict Sharia law, setbacks for women and relations with Israel? So start with Mohammed Morsi. Who is he?
He is the Muslim Brotherhood's second choice candidate because their charismatic first choice got disqualified by the Elections Commission. So he's kind of a gray bureaucrat in the sort of Brotherhood's hierarchy, but he commands their incredible, formidable nationwide machine. And it's really important to remember the Muslim Brotherhood is the only political organization in Egypt that has a national get-out-the-vote machine. Its own tacticians estimate that they could turn out as many as 9 million votes, and it's something they've been doing for 60 years. So even in the years when elections weren't free and fair, the Muslim Brotherhood was driving its people down to the polls. Often they weren't allowed to vote, but they have a lot of experience doing this, and that is really their sort of dark horse strength.
Well, and is he considered moderate or more fundamentalist?
Oh, he is the most fundamentalist of the surviving viable candidates. Mm-hmm. He is a sort of fire and brimstone, old school Islamist, and he's got the sort of most hard line of the Brotherhood's religious views, and at the same time, he doesn't have their modern pragmatic economic program that their original frontrunner had.
Well, that's as opposed to another candidate who's an ex-Muslim Brotherhood member who's sort of selling himself as a bridge candidate, a liberal Islamist. Tell us about Abdelmanyam Aboulfoutouya.
Dr. Aboulfoutouya is a former Muslim brother, medical doctor, very well loved by the Muslim Brotherhood itself, and also very well loved by the bearded Salafis, who are the most fundamentalist of the Islamists in Egypt today. He has tried to sell himself as the bridge to the future, a man who can attract fundamentalist Muslims and secular liberal revolutionaries. And to some extent, he's proved that in his campaign. A lot of his volunteers are young people, secular activists who were part of the revolution in Tahrir. But he's really failed to convince the secular liberal electorate that he's not really a stalking horse for the Muslim Brotherhood or for Islamism.
Well, then you have Amir Moussa, who's a former Arab League chief who is presenting himself as a secular, sort of an elder statesman who can stand against the Islamist tide. You have Hamdine Sabahi, a former journalist. He's campaigning as a follower of the former president or the former leader of the Egyptian Revolution, President Abdel Nasser. And Ahmed Shafik, who was Mubarak's prime minister. Parse those.
Well, so this is, I know it might seem like soup to your listeners, but these are really interesting and important distinctions. So you have on the far right, the sort of worst case scenario, you have Ahmed Shafik, former Air Force general. And this is a guy who on the campaign trail has been saying, on my watch, nobody's going to be allowed to protest. It's going to be like the good old days under Mubarak, where we don't have traffic blocked and nonsensical young people making demands of people like me who know better. And that really has appealed to the law and order constituency, the people who have been freaked out by the instability of revolutionary Egypt. And he has the backing of the old ruling party. And it appears he has the backing of at least some of the military dictatorship. So he's the most alarming prospect. He universally alarms liberals, Islamists, revolutionaries, young people. Everybody's, except for his supporters, are kind of terrified of him. Then we have Amr Moussa, who's tried to sell himself, as you said, as a statesman. But he is viewed with a lot of mistrust because he was a Mubarak lieutenant for decades. Finally, there's Hamdine Sabahi, who is the only secular revolutionary in the race who has a fighting chance. But he's also a Nasserist. And it's worth remembering Nasser was a quite oppressive dictator who also made a hash of Egypt's economy and security. And Sabahi is a man who has nothing but admiration for Nasser. And that's something that should cause alarm for someone who's thinking about what he would do if in the unlikely event that he were elected president.
Well, wow. So it really is all over the map. We just got a couple minutes here. What do you think is going to happen? I mean, is it really that up in the air? And what are Egyptians telling you? Because we know that in the parliamentary elections, two-thirds of 27 million Egyptians who voted for Islamist parties. But several of them said that was then I would vote for a secular president.
Well, the really important thing to think about is that politics is finally happening in Egypt. So no matter how dissatisfying this pool of candidates is, and it really is a dissatisfying group, Egyptians are getting to sort out what their political preferences are. They are having a dominant voice here. And the real take-home message is that everybody, even this Ahmed Shafik fellow, have been going to the public and asking them for support and genuinely campaigning.
Ahmed Shafik, again, the right-wing, you know, Mubarak's former prime minister, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so the people are actually the most important factor in this process. And you can't begin to comprehend what a huge shift that is in an Egypt where literally for millennia, there has never been a chief executive who was accountable to the people. So no matter how badly it turns out, that's the first thing to keep in mind. The second thing is no matter who wins, again, the real power struggle is going to be between the elected president and the military, and the military still holds all the power behind the scenes. And then finally, the sort of complex but long game here is the constitution that still hasn't even been a convention called to write it, but there's going to be a new constitution written that's going to shape this new state, and that is really going to be the cornerstone of what comes next.
But as you said, and we read in your reading, which we'll post it here now. In your writing, which we'll post it here now. org. Egyptians are very excited about this opportunity. We'll continue to follow it with you. Thanasi Kambanis, thanks so much.
Great to talk to you, Robin.
Judy Blume is back. Of course, she never went away. Her influence on young adult readers has lasted over four decades. Books like Forever, about high schoolers choosing to have responsible sex. The Fudge series, about the kid who swallowed his brother's turtle. Writers like Chuck Palahniuk and Diablo Cody have written tributes to Judy Blume. Then there was that scene in Talladega Nights when Ricky Bobby is in the hospital and another character reads, "Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret," to him, that book being about a young woman having her first period. Judy Blume has only made teeny adjustments to the books over the years. Now she's taking one of them, Tiger Eyes, to the big screen. And those Fudge books, the first one, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, celebrates its 40th anniversary this year with a special anniversary release. The book, of course, the story of Peter, the fourth grader whose closest companion is his pet turtle Dribble, and his life's misery is, well, listen.
My biggest problem is my brother, Farley Drexel Hatcher. He's 2.5 years old. Everybody calls him Fudge. I feel sorry for him if he's going to grow up with a name like Fudge, but I don't say a word. It's none of my business. Fudge is always in my way. He messes up everything he sees, and when he gets mad, he throws himself flat on the floor and he screams, and he kicks, and he bangs his fists. The only time I really like him is when he's sleeping. He sucks four fingers on his left hand, and he makes a slurping noise. When Fudge saw Dribble, he said, "Oh, see." And I said, "That's my turtle, get it? Mine. You don't touch him." Fudge said, "No touch." Then he laughed like crazy.
Judy Blume reading from Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, and readers know so much for that promise. Judy Blume joins us from the NPR studios in Culver City, California. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do we remember that you based Fudge, who was this little 2 to 3 year old, on your own son, and now your son is directing this new movie?
Isn't that fabulous? Yeah. Actually, yeah, I did get some of the little details, like wanting to eat dinner under the table, calling himself Frisky the cat. And, you know, whoever dreamed that Larry would grow up to become a producer and a director, and that we would have the wonderful really thrill of working together. I think we're both old enough now. You know, we tried it when we were younger and it didn't work as well, but we're old enough and mature enough now to know that the director's always in charge.
Well, I just reread Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, and it struck me in reading it again years and years later that it's sort of a death of a salesman for the younger set. You know, I was so surprised at how Peter's dad, who makes commercials, how he's treated by his clients.
Yeah, I'm trying. Yes, it's true. It's true. I just haven't thought about that in a long time. Yeah, you know, Hatcher, you get that kid on that toddle bike or you can forget the account. Yes.
Oh, it's just I didn't pick that up the first time around.
Probably most kids don't either.
Yeah. Well, and we understand you had a hard time. You know, it's extraordinarily successful. But you had a hard time getting a publisher, even though the basis, we're not giving anything away here. Well, we already did. That the heart of the story is that Fudge does eat the turtle. And that was based on a real story?
That was based on a real story that I read in a newspaper. I like to say not eats it because that implies chewing it. But just, you know, as toddlers do, put this little thing in his mouth and gulped. Yes, and it wasn't that I had a hard time finding a publisher. It was that I wrote it only as a picture book, and it was the last chapter where Fudge does away with dribble. And, yeah, I had some funny rejection letters. You know, this is really funny, but it teaches little kids to swallow turtles, so we can't publish it. But once Anne Durrell saw it, and she was at Dutton, and said, what would you think about writing about this family in what we now call a chapter book? You know, then it was just, and every chapter would be kind of a different story about the same family. I never thought of it. I was a very new writer, and I loved the idea.
Yeah. Well, it's extraordinarily successful, and now Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing is celebrating its 40th anniversary. Did you ever think of having Fudge grow up, or did you update this book in any way?
Well, I would never have Fudge grow up. No, first grade is as far as he's getting. Yeah. I don't update the books, and I know that there's a lot of controversy about it. Yes, I did change the electronics in the book, which I don't think has anything to do with the story, only because the books were written over many, many, many years with lots of books in between. And yet Peter goes from fourth grade to fifth to sixth to seventh right in a row, and the electronics weren't right, and so I did change them. I don't know if that was the right thing to do or not, because so many of my early readers resent it. Yes, Margaret gets to use sticky pads now instead of pins and belts.
Just to remind people, this is Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and it's, again, a story about a little girl anticipating her first period, and you did sort of change that, so she's not wearing those belt contraptions that, you know.
You know, that nobody understood. Nobody understood.
What's that?
But this is what I've promised my readers who are angry about that, my very first readers. I'm writing a book now that takes place in 1952, and I've promised those readers that there will be belts and pins.
Okay. Well, there. We have that to look forward to. But what about the book Forever that was controversial in its day, and it's still on the American Library Association's lists of books that have been banned or challenged in libraries and schools? You know, I was thinking, when thinking about Forever and even Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, do you think you'd have a harder time publishing that now?
I think that in the 80s, I might have had a harder time publishing it. The 70s was a very good time for children's book writers and children's books and children who were readers. And people weren't so fearful as they became in the 80s. That was a tough time, maybe the 90s too. You know, everything is cyclical. And I think we're back into a time when publishers are less afraid. One hopes that libraries have their policies in place so that if a parent comes in waving a book and demands its removal from the library, that parent has to fill out reasons why, and then there are committees that it goes through. Where in the 80s, you know, a parent came waving a book and everybody was afraid, and a librarian or teacher might remove that book. But I have to speak up for the librarians and teachers who have all these years been there to fight for their students' intellectual freedom, even when their jobs were in jeopardy. they believed in standing up for those kids and taught the kids also to stand up for themselves and the books they wanted to read. Any parent can say at any time, I don't want my child to read that book. What you can't do is say, I don't want that book available to children, period.
One of our colleagues, Kevin, was saying he used to love going over a friend's house because all the girls would sit around together and read forever.
You know, on Twitter right now, there are a lot of men coming forward and saying, well, I grew up on those books. I learned everything about girls from reading Margaret or Forever. I love the idea of boys reading about girls and girls reading about boys. I mean, what could be better? We're stuck together here, guys, you know. We got to get to know each other.
That's children's author Judy Blume. Her book, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, celebrates its 40th anniversary this year. She's also got a new film based on her book, Tiger Eyes. Judy Blume, thanks so much.
Thank you.